Welcome to the Newcastle Witches podcast. Thank you for listening. This is episode 13, They Live Among Us. This episode is dedicated to Anne Watson. Our guest today is Michelle Brock, an associate professor of history at Washington and Lee University in Virginia. She completed her PhD at the University of Texas. She is a scholar of religion and the supernatural in early modern Scotland, and the author of Satan and the Scots, The Devil in Post-Reformation Scotland. She's also the co-editor of Knowing Demons, Knowing Spirits in the Early Modern Period, and the forthcoming Routledge History of the Devil in the Western Tradition. She is currently completing her second monograph, Plagues of the Heart, Piety, Crisis, and Community in 17th Century Scotland. I reached out to chat to Professor Brock after reading a few of her articles online. I thought she had a really adept way of articulating the struggle of learning about witch trials and understanding them in an empathetic way where you can learn from them, when you can be sort of reflect on it personally, which has definitely been part of the journey of making this podcast. But also I'm really interested to understand sort of how sort of witch hunts and the terminology around accusing somebody of being a witch, calling somebody a witch, how we use it today, how we use it on to target people online, how we use it to ridicule people, how it's, you know, still really prevalent as a way of mocking and demeaning somebody. And I thought, well, I'll just reach out to her and see if she's interested in sort of reflecting on these things with me and giving me some of her insights into it. So I really hope that people enjoy this conversation and find it as insightful as I did. Certainly the final question that she proposes to me definitely whirled around in my head for a few hours. Thank you for joining us today, Mickey. First of all, I'm curious to know, why did you choose to study witches and witchcraft?
Yeah, so I've thought about this question a lot, just because I get asked it all the time. People will often say to me that I seem like a very nice, normal person. Why am I studying the history of witchcraft and the history of the devil, which is really my specialty? I think for me, I grew up in a relatively religious community, and I always had questions that were unanswered. You know, when you grow up in an evangelical community, there's sort of this sense that there are certain things that can be beyond the pale of asking, right? You shouldn't always push, that there's some things that need to be received wisdom based on faith. And I always wanted to know more. So I was that kid who was going to the library, checking out books on werewolves and witches and ghosts and all of that sort of thing from a really young age. And I think for me, you know, as I got into the historical field, beyond my own personal interest in religion and these unanswered questions, I became fascinated by how people tried to understand the world around them, how they tried to find explanation for tragedy, for the signs that the world, the universe might be giving them. And witchcraft, certainly in the period that I work on, the early modern era, was a profound explanatory tool to understand why tragedy struck, why people's lives were so hard. And to me, what's really interesting about history is thinking about the past as a laboratory in which we can test the consequences of human thought. And I think witchcraft is a real example of that. How does belief really matter? How does it shape lives and change lives, and often tragic ways, as of course the listeners to this podcast will know. So my interest in history, my personal interests, those sort of collided and choosing to study this sort of thing.
I obviously didn't come to witches and witchcraft in a sort of intellectual academic way. It was very much like a lived experience of somebody I know, a relative of mine. being called a witch and being demonized and being mocked for their appearance and for being outspoken and all these things. And I think that sort of started my own fascination, is why do people rely on this stereotype so much?
Yes, yes.
And sort of why it still persists as the go-to sort of insult. And also just the, it's different to how it was in the 16th and 17th century. But I wondered if you had any reflections on why we still call people witches in a derogatory way.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a wonderful question. And I'll say from the outset, one of the things that's really interesting to me when you look at the broad scope of history all the way through to the present is the persistence of what I think of as this youthful, movable fiction, that there's this great satanic underground conspiracy of people seeking to overthrow a group in power. And that's fundamentally the idea that's at the core of anti-Semitism. It's fundamentally the idea that that's at the core of the sort of heresy trials of the 13th and 14th century. It's the idea that that's at the core of the witch trials. And it's also the idea that persists in the satanic panics of the 1980s mm-hmm. and all the way through to all of the QAnon conspiracy theories in the US in recent years, right? That there is this group seeking to subvert power through dealings with the devil. It's a really powerful fiction because demonizing people is an easy sort of get out of jail free card, right? It's a way to express fear, to understand it, but also to, I think, preserve structures of power to some degree. And certainly in, you know, the period that I work on, the fear of witches was very real, right? It wasn't, yeah. The hunting of witches was not done in a cynical way. It was done because people genuinely feared witches. But when you ask, why did people fear witches? Then the question becomes more complicated, right? They feared a sort of threat to the power of Christendom. They feared sort of the wrath of God, all these other things. So I give you that sort of long prelude to say that this idea just of the satanic conspiracy has mm-hmm. so much sort of historical salience through time. More specifically to the question of why people are still labeled a witch, right? In the year, you know, 2023, I think the reason that term still has power and certainly carries with it these profound misogynistic underpinnings is because everybody knows what it means. It's a really easy way to demonize someone, to say you are unnatural, right? Mm-hmm. Usually an unnatural woman, someone who's not sort of subscribing to the way, the natural course of things, right? The way women ought to act and behave. Now, of course, in the early modern period, not all witches were women, but the vast majority were, right? And when people yeah. imagined a witch in their mind in the 16th and 17th century, they imagined a woman, and usually a woman who was a bad woman, who had done something to subvert society in a certain sort of way, or a woman who got caught up in that sort of panic. And today, I think because everybody knows what the witch entails, that term is such a useful insult. And it's, again, it's a lazy one, right? It's a sort of lazy way to demonize someone because it carries so much meaning within it, right? When you say she's a witch, people immediately know, even if they've never studied the age of the witch hunts, they picture an old woman, an unnatural woman, an ugly woman, a woman who speaks in ways she shouldn't, right? And I think popular culture has done a lot in some ways to sort of carry through those stereotypes while also turning them on their head, right? There's sort of mm-hmm. this idea too of the witch now as a modern empowering figure. But I think people who want to use the label to demonize folks can draw from this very long well of history.
Yeah. I think
it's just a very convenient shorthand.
One thing you mentioned that's like, I hope you don't mind if I pick up on it, is mentioning QAnon and modern day conspiracy theories. And I think a lot of people, certainly when they feedback to us, are like, oh, but how did they, you know, really believe that in witches and magic? And it's the same with modern day conspiracy theories. There are people, I've met a few people who do believe in Flat Earth and do believe in, do subscribe a lot to QAnon or those kind of COVID conspiracies as well. They are very firm in their beliefs. They are absolutely convinced of it. And sometimes I kind of feel like, I wonder if that was what it was like back then when somebody said, you know, that woman looked at me strangely and then my cow got injured. I wonder if it's the same sort of sentiment or sort of mindset.
Yeah. So, you know, that's such a great question. And I teach a class on the history of the devil, actually, where we talk about the witch trials, but then we also talk about the satanic panic mechanics of the 80s, early 90s, and then we talk about QAnon. And this sort of question comes up. I mean, is sort of conspiracy theory belief now akin, analogous to conspiracy theory belief, in the 16th, 17th century? I think a critical difference potentially is that just the vast, vast majority of people believed in the conspiracy of witches in the early modern period. It was a fear that everyone from the peasant to a king, really, in the British context, got involved in, invested in. Now, certainly, there were always voices who sort of raised their hand and said, "I'm not sure that what we're calling witchcraft is actually witchcraft, or perhaps these are just poor old melancholic women who don't know what they're saying." But it was the dominant belief, and even the women themselves who were accused of witchcraft, partially because of the sort of stress of torture, interrogation, and so forth, probably may have believed at some point that they were witches because of the power of that suggestion, or at least believed in the reality of witchcraft, right? So all of which is to say, it was so normative, so mainstream. The vast majority of people believed this in the early modern period. I think now, particularly with something like QAnon, while it's not as fringe as I would like it to be, unfortunately, it still has a tremendous amount of salience. I think there is just a difference in degree of how popularized these things are. And that's partially because people's access to information is so much broader now. So you really have to find the right corners of the internet to sort of get into all of this morass of QAnon conspiracy theory. When in the period of the witch trials, the main systems of information were ones coming from the church, were ones coming from the state, were coming from the institutions that themselves were pushing belief in witches, or at least fostering an environment and a legal system through which witches could be prosecuted. To me, what's so concerning about when people in positions of power today decide to peddle the conspiracy theory is that we know from history that that has power, right? When you have a sort of president giving subtle nods of approval to QAnon, or using the language of witch hunts or conspiracy theories about elections or whatever, that's powerful. So to me, what really makes the difference is, are people in positions of power peddling the conspiracy theory? And I think that's where things get into very dangerous territory in the past, and in the present too.
Oh, that's an excellent point, because I always want to be comforted in the fact that, no, it's like we've moved on, we've learned from history. But then, as you say, when people of power hang on to those stereotypes, that's when you are in trouble.
Yeah, and I think we are still a society that, even if we are not hunting witches, we still have, and by we, I mean sort of American society, British society, European society, we still have a profound tendency to demonize. I mean, and to sort of, instead of trying to understand a group or understand a phenomena, instead to label it sort of something other, something maybe a little bit less than human, right? That's that process of demonization, of othering, as a way basically to separate ourselves from a different group that we don't understand. That's still so salient. I remember that being a real animating factor of the world after 9/11 and the beginnings of the Iraq War, with all the Islamophobia that was so profound, at least on this side of the Atlantic. I think you see that in the sort of trans panics that are happening now, and sort of the real demonization of trans women and trans men, right? It's sort of that impulse to demonize maybe what we don't fully understand is still sadly with us. So we want to sort of take comfort, when we study something like the witch hunts, take comfort in our own perceived sort of modernity and greater levels of humanity. But of course, that's not really the case. We still share those same ways of dealing with fear and perceived threats to power.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I will admit to is that through the course of this podcast, of learning in very particular cases as well, like a couple of episodes that we did, like delving into actual testimony, one from the person that was writing the testimony, and others like the person that was accusing witches and stuff like that, and trying to find, I guess, compassion rather than judgment, and then moving that into my own life and thinking of my own biases. People accusing somebody of witch, they really believe that it could be a possibility that this person was a witch. And it's hard for me to kind of be in that mindset, obviously, because I'm not in the same century, but I try to relate it all the time back to, like, what am I doing now, and how am I engaging with people that I fundamentally disagree with? and trying to be compassionate. But I admit that something that's not something that occurred to me before. Not because I think I'm a terrible person, but it just didn't occur to me.
Well, and I think, you know, it's so true that when we try to understand the witch trials, we have to understand them on their own terms, right? In the context of the perceived realities that people were living. And these were lives, I tell my students all the time, people in the 16th, 17th century, you know, if they looked at our world, they would say, we all live in houses filled with thousands of candles, and we all own the equivalent of hundreds of horses, right? And the access to transportation. And we have a magical ability not to get sick. I mean, our lives today are so profoundly comfortable by comparison. Mm-hmm. And I think the way that fear operated and death and sort of need for explanations in the early modern period is different, right? So in fact, I think the burden to understand and to be compassionate and empathetic to me strikes me as more necessary in doing the historical work. I think you can recognize that the witch hunts were not some cynical ploy. They were not woman hunting per se or anything like that. They were really about hunting witches and a fear of witches. I think you can recognize that on one hand, and then also say this was a profound tragedy rooted in some really dangerous beliefs related to misinterpretations of Genesis 3 or whatever it might have been, right? That perfect storm of ingredients that led to the witch hunts, the use of torture, low evidentiary standards, all of that. In terms of taking that compassion and saying, how do you apply that to people who you disagree with in the present? Like you, I have trouble doing that sometimes, not least because I think people now are literate. They have a lot of access to information at their disposal. I think there are very clear cases now of people promoting conspiracy theories while knowing that they were false, right? And doing it in a cynical way to maintain power. And that's where I don't have as much sort of empathy or sympathy. But the broader point of taking belief seriously, yes, we have to do that, right? We have to take it seriously if we want to understand it. And it doesn't mean we have to believe in it or agree with it in any way. But I do think if we want to make sort of useful arguments about compassion and humanity, then you have to sort of genuinely understand people's fear or discomfort or positions that might be different than you. But I think, I struggle with the empathy part too sometimes in the present. So I'm very sympathetic to that, particularly if I think someone believes in a cause that to me is fundamentally dehumanizing or demonizing to others. That can be a challenge.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to start a fight, but at the same time, you're very angry.
Well, and I think, but anger is powerful historically. We act like it's not, but of course it was. You know, I mean, anger was pivotal to all sorts of movements, abolition, the right for women to get the vote, all of these things. We shouldn't shy away from the power of righteous anger. But the question is, how do you sort of channel it and make it productive, right?
My next question is about language, really. Nowadays, we hear people claim to be, you know, the victims of a witch hunt. Other times, though, I see women, particularly women who are outspoken, journalists, academics, writers, being attacked and lots of quite violent, misogynistic language being used towards them. So I suppose I'm fascinated with how we use the term or how we accuse people of being witches and why we use people of being witches and how our language is maybe similar to, you know, back in the day when witch hunts were a very real thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, language is fluid, right? Language changes over time. So I don't want to sort of be a purist about how we can apply the label of witch hunt, which to me, of course, means something very specific because of what I study. You know, I think at the core of it, the question is the sort of ganging up on, is the abuse of, is the sort of demonizing of folks, is it coming from the position of power or not? That makes a lot of difference. So to me, when someone in a position of power, Trump or Harvey Weinstein or someone in this, or actually, I mean, Boris Johnson's ally said this with regard to the way that people were sort of treating his violations of COVID guidelines and so forth, called that a witch hunt. And if this is something directed if a person in a position of power is claiming to be the victim of witch hunt, and actually nothing really bad is happening to them, they're still living their lives just as they did, they're still a billionaire or millionaire, whatever it is, I'm less sympathetic to that, right? In fact, I'm not at all sympathetic to that. I think usually witch hunts were about, they came from people in positions of power against those who had less power fundamentally, who were women, who may have been widowed, who may have been in some way on the margins of society, or at the very least didn't have their hand on the levers of power.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's sort of one case that I definitely don't think is a witch hunt. And in fact, is, I think, a purposeful abuse of that term by usually men in positions of power to say, this is a witch hunt against me. Well, no, it's not. But to the question of maybe what happened to your relative, I think, I don't know if I would call it a witch hunt or not, but it sounds like, and certainly there are examples of this where people are demonized, people are sort of brutalized in various ways that have real genuine consequences. And particularly, you know, the term witch hunt is meant to sort of communicate that you're being accused of something, you're the victim of accusations that are not true, that are fundamentally illegitimate. That's what witch hunt sort of means, right? And I think when that is the case, then I think potentially we can use that term in a more a sort of truer, more faithful sort of way. You know, the witch trials historically, you know, they were legal. These were legal functions, right?
Yeah.
They were not extrajudicial. They processed through the courts. There were real consequences, including death. So I think if we're thinking about it in that way, then maybe only in a few very rarefied cases could people in the modern world be victims, or at least in the West, be victims of witch hunts. But do we still use the same tools of demonization, particularly against groups like women or individuals who are different than others in society? We absolutely do. And so, you know, actually, I think the way we should think about this is we may not have witches anymore, per se, right? And we certainly, in the way that they envisioned them in the early modern
yeah.
period, of course, there are lots of modern practitioners of witchcraft who identify as Wiccan or variously as witches, but we don't have early modern sort of demonic conspiracy witches anymore. But we certainly still have witch hunters. And maybe that's what we should be talking about. People who want to use their own power, their own privilege to demonize others in a way that is really dangerous in the
mm-hmm.
rhetoric that they use and the way they whip up people into a fervor. And so if it's emanating from a position of power, this desire to victimize someone, then I think maybe that's more similar to what you're talking about there.
And I guess that leads on quite nicely, I guess, is like, why do you feel so passionate about teaching about witch hunts and witches, and what do you feel people can learn from them?
Yeah, so you know what's so I think lots of things are important about teaching about it. I think not least because of what I had said about history is the sort of laboratory we have in which to test the consequences of thought.
Yeah.
Right. What's the dangerous legacy of a particular reading of Genesis 3 that says Eve was tempted by the serpent from the beginning and the serpent was Satan, right? I mean, what's the legacy of that idea? Why does it matter? What's the legacy of ideas that think about women first and foremost as mothers and fundamentally unnatural if they are not or if they do? I mean, there are lots of these legacies and those ideas that we can kind of tease out of the witch trials. And I think there's a lot of power in that and a lot of sort of lessons about what we believe. But I think probably at my core, you know, when I teach about the witch hunts, like teaching about any event in history, students always want to sort of look at the trials and say, well, I would have been Reginald Scott, or I would have been Johann Weyer, someone who was willing to sort of raise their hand and say, hold up, this has gone too far, or we're skeptical about it in various ways. Or when they look at this past, they imagine themselves potentially as a victim, right? I mean, certainly when I study the age of the witch hunts, I certainly fit a lot of the profile of, you know, a woman accused of witchcraft, right? Like mouthy, you know, doesn't have children, various other, very independent, whatever it might be. But the reality is most of us, if we lived in the 16th and 17th century, we would not have been a victim and we would not have been someone raising their hand and asking questions. We probably would have been someone pointing the finger.
Mm-hmm.
We would have potentially been someone, you know, pulling the strings of power. We would have actually been more akin to the witch hunters than the hunted. And that is a hard reality to swallow, but it's true. And whenever we look at the past, we always want to envision, well, I would have been an abolitionist instead of someone supporting the trade in enslaved persons. Well, probably not, actually. Most people follow sort of instructions of power, they follow norms, they don't always question those things. And I wish when people study the witch hunts, and this is actually an observation, a colleague of mine, Julian Goddard, who wrote a really good book on the European witch hunt made, which is this sort of wish that people, when they studied the witch hunts, instead of identifying with the victims, would look at themselves and look at their society and actually ask, to what extent are they complicit in things that could be akin to witch hunts, whatever it might be, right? So studying history is about, and the witch hunts in particular, for me, is about empathy, is about trying to understand the power of thought and the dangers of people who try to stoke fear in society, right? Really dangerous to try and get people to fear other groups. But then also to recognize the demonizing impulses in their own societies and themselves, and work to make sure that they are not complicit in the types of historical tragedies that are akin to the way we now see the witch hunts. Because without a doubt, 300 years from now, people will look at things our society does and find them just as appalling, just as bizarre, just as inhumane as we find the witch hunts. And that's something important to grapple with, I think.
That's a lot to reflect on, but that's an interesting question. I think, would I have spoken up? Would I have said anything, or would I just be complicit? It's very unnerving to think of it as.
It is. And I ask my students this question on the final day of class, and the poor students, like, that's what they leave class thinking about. It's a very heavy question, but it is important one, right? Like, what would one stand up for? It's a useful experiment, for sure.
Those are all my questions, and that's a very like heavy answer. Like you said, like just like your students, I know how they feel. To finish this conversation, because I think I'm going to be thinking about it all the way home now, of and I'm sure other people listening will too. So I just want to say thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with me today, and for agreeing to do this transatlantic interview as well. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Newcastle Witches podcast. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back again soon with another episode called The North Remembers Not. In the meantime, you can find us on social media under the Newcastle Witches podcast.